Publishers prepare to pack for London while the Supreme Court sends John Wiley & Sons packing with a copyright-related ruling that the first sale doctrine applies as well in Bangkok as it does in Berkeley. Hello and welcome to Copyright Clearance and his podcast series Beyond the Book. My name is Chris Keneally, your host and producer, and joining me on the line as he does each week on Fridays is Andrew Albany, senior writer for Publishers Weekly. Andrew, welcome back.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, we have some news to start off with about a preview in your upcoming edition for the London Book Fair, and tell us what we'll find there.
That's right. It's that time of year again when we start having meetings all over the globe. And in Monday's edition, we start with our London Book Fair preview, the centerpiece of which, as always, will be my colleague Rachel Deal's London Briefcase, in which she takes a good look at the titles and rights that agents and publishers are going to be bringing with them to London in hopes of a deal. As always, there's some big names in there and a lot of sleepers that are sure to generate interest in the fair. I should also note, while we're talking about trips, that the Bologna Children's Book Fair is underway, and readers can check out the PW website next week for our coverage. We're there as well. But back to London for a moment. That meeting kicks off in April, and on a personal note, I have to say that I love the London Book Fair. And hey, why not, right? It's London. It's one of the truly great cities in the world. But in terms of the book business, London, like Frankfurt, which is another annual event I truly love attending, has done a really good job with its programming and a really good job keeping the event fresh and vital. And last year was another strong year for London, with attendance about 26,000 for the three-day fair, and that was up once again over the previous year. And this year's fair is set to build on some of the innovations that London has pursued over the last couple of years. For example, there's going to be more self-publishing. There's going to be more self-publishing-related programming in the Authors Lounge at the fair. And there's going to be an expanded slate of presentations at the Digital Zone Theater right there on the show floor. And also, there's at the Digital Minds Conference, which is the Sunday before the show actually kicks off, Neil Gaiman is scheduled to speak, so I'm pretty amped up for that. And I'll add one final note, and that's that PW will be covering the show with the show daily. So if you're actually in London at the fair, be sure to look for copies there on the show floor, done with our partners at Book Brunch. And also, the show daily content is going to be available on the PW website as well. So if you can't make it to London, you can still follow our coverage.
Well, oh, to be in England now that April's there. I won't be able to join you, unfortunately, but I'll take this opportunity to tell listeners about some things that Copyright Clearance Center is participating in. As you mentioned, there is the Digital Minds Conference, their Future of Publishing Content Program, that is a pre-conference event. And on that Sunday, April 14th, Michael Healy, my colleague here, will be joining Richard Mollett from the UK Publishers Association and several other leading spokespeople for the publishing industry for a program in the afternoon called Copyright What Next. And then Michael is also a referee, as they call them, for something called The Great Debate, which is an annual event, and this year it happens on the 16th of April, looking at the fight for survival. And in one corner are all the outsiders and the startups, including Alan Lau, who's the co-founder of Wattpad, taking on the heavyweights in the publishing business to see who ultimately will deliver a knockout punch. So we don't want to miss that. And Andrew, let's get back to what you mentioned at the start there, which is Rachel's Wright briefcase. We mentioned about packing and so forth, and unfortunately, the Supreme Court sent somebody packing today, or this week.
That's right. So, you know, for those not steeped in copyright geekery like you and I are, Chris, last week's Supreme Court decision in Kurtzsang versus Wiley may not have been the most exciting headline, but I'm going to paraphrase Joe Biden here. You know, this is a big effing deal. You know, by a 6-3 margin, the court last week held that first sale, which is the copyright provision that enables owners to resell or otherwise dispose of their legally acquired copies, is not limited only to copies made in the U.S. And while that may seem like a narrow, simple point, I'm going to lead off Monday's news section with a few reasons why it is, in fact, so important.
Before you do that, though, Andrew, can you briefly recap the case for us? As you say, not everybody follows these cases as closely as you and I do.
Good point. Sure. So while studying at USC, Supap Kersang, a Thai-born U.S. student, started a little side business in which he began to import cheaper-priced English language editions of textbooks, books that were made for sale exclusively abroad, and he began reselling them on eBay and other websites in the U.S., undercutting the market for the more expensive U.S. editions. Now, as our listeners probably know, publishers price books differently. So in Thailand, for example, textbooks will be cheaper than they are in the U.S., and it's that price difference potential that basically set up Kurt Zang's arbitrage business. Wiley was not so impressed with Kurt Zang's business, however, and they sued him. They claimed that his side gig violated copyright law, specifically Section 602, which prohibits the importing of copyrighted works without permission, and Section 106, which prohibits the distribution of those unauthorized copies. In his defense, however, Kurt Zang claimed that Section 109 of the Copyright Act, which is what we commonly refer to as the doctrine of first sale, gave him the right to sell the books without the copyright owner's permission. And he had a point. In fact, he had a pretty strong defense, attorneys say. Section 109 is, in fact, a full defense, but there's a crucial ambiguity. It only applies to copies that are lawfully made under the U.S. Copyright Act. Now, the district court ruled for Wiley. They held that since these textbooks that Kurt Zang was importing were manufactured overseas, where U.S. copyright law is not the law of the land, the books were therefore not lawfully made. And by two to one margin, a three-judge panel of the Second Circuit upheld that. They expressly held that first sale was, in fact, limited exclusively to those works made in territories where the U.S. Copyright Act is law and not to foreign manufactured works. Now, that decision raised alarms for a number of stakeholders, including libraries and used book dealers and technology companies, and especially consumer goods retailers, all of whom weighed in with amicus briefs urging the court to overturn the ruling. And in so doing, they detailed what was known as a parade of horribles that the ruling would create, that libraries might not be able to lend books that were merely printed, not necessarily published, overseas, that used booksellers could not resell those books, that museums might not even be able to confidently display copyrighted works, and that goods embedded with copyrighted technology, such as, you know, foreign manufactured cars, for example, that they could not be resold. And companies like Amazon and eBay, they would never be able to confirm that the goods that people were reselling on their platforms were all lawfully made under the U.S. Copyright Act. In oral arguments, Kurt Zang's attorneys argued that limiting first sale to a geographic law would basically create this irresistible incentive for U.S. companies to start offshoring their manufacturing. Because, hey, if you produced your goods overseas, it gave you sort of this endless, eternal downstream control over sales and rentals, and the ability to sort of destroy secondary markets like the used book trade that compete with you. Now, the publishers dismissed these concerns as nothing more than trumped-up hypotheticals. None of these horribles was likely to occur, they argued. But in the end, they never really were able to say why. And ultimately, the court overturned the lower courts, stating that there was, in fact, no geographic limit to first sale. So that's the case in a nutshell.
Well, then, Counselor, what's the likely effect of this ruling?
Well, it remains to be seen what the likely effect is going to be in practice. But attorneys tell me that the Kurt Zang opinion seriously undermines the ability to sell English language territorial rights. After all, if Kurt Zang can buy cheap foreign editions and sell them, so too can Amazon or eBay or anyone else. As Professor James Grimmelman, who's a PW contributing editor and a professor of law at New York Law School, for now, he is moving to the University of Maryland, as he explained it to me, in this age of the internet and cheap shipping, the price differential between two foreign editions in the same English language is going to collapse, and that language and not territory is going to become the only rights that really matter. After all, why would I buy a $30 American hardcover a book if I could go on Amazon and get a $10 Canadian edition? They're both in English, and Amazon can deliver them both right to my door. You know, thus, you know, publishers are understandably concerned that this cornerstone, a small but nevertheless a meaningful cornerstone of their business, territorial rights, may now be moot. Now, that said, we've been talking about the collapse of territorial rights for a long time in the age of the internet, especially at book fairs like London and Frankfurt. So it isn't like we didn't see this all coming and weren't kind of preparing for this. Nevertheless, publishers are understandably upset.
Right. And in your column for Monday, you've got some more interesting points to make.
Yeah, I do. You know, my first impression when I read the ruling was that this is another big loss for publishers in court in a copyright case. And for me, that raises a couple of issues that I'm writing about on Monday. The first is, you know, publishers, we need to talk about your problem, because clearly the copyright law doesn't actually say what you seem to want it to say. You know, from Kurt Zang to Google to the Georgia State case, there is a reason that publishers are constantly getting hammered in court, right? I mean, let's put it this way. How many press releases can publishers release that begin with the words, "We are disappointed in the court's decision," before they realize that, hey, you know, maybe the problem is ours? Now, that said, the bigger point here is that copyright law is almost certainly in need of an update for the digital age. And that's certainly true in the Kurtzain case. You know, if there was ever an indicator of that very fact, it's in the Kurtzain decision, where pages were devoted to Justices Breyer and Ginsburg debating what the word under means. You know, simply put, the Copyright Act as constructed did not envision what technology has now wrought. And clearly, there's very real tension between some of the various provisions in the Copyright Act, definitely in the Kurtzain case. In his majority opinion, Supreme Court Justice Breyer, that is, says as much. You know, the fact is, whether it's digitization or e-reserves or cheap resale of books over the internet, these are market factors that are really too big to be left to the courts to decide using a law that still has its roots in the 17th century English bookselling trade. You know, as virtually every stakeholder is in the Kurtzain decision has now alluded, you know, Congress is on deck. Congress has to step up and do something here. Now, Register of Copyrights Maria Palante has been angling toward a reform of copyright law. But without sounding too cynical, you know, I have to say good luck with that. And not just because Congress is, you know, pretty dysfunctional. I think it's safe to say that now, given our budget strife. Congress isn't exactly in a compromising mood, but because there are now so many stakeholders that have been drawn into the copyright debate that getting consensus on any of this stuff, new companies, old companies, new businesses versus old business, it's going to be nearly impossible. You know, clearly the battle has to shift. It can't continue on in the courts. I would hope that publishers would realize that now after the string of drubbings they've been taking. And if Kurtzain demonstrates anything, I think it's that, you know, copyright is kind of buckling under the weight of a new digital world, and it really does need to be addressed.
Well, as you say, Andrew, the Register of Copyright, Maria Palante, has in fact been strongly suggesting that it is time for Congress to look at all of this again. She did so just recently this week, and she pointed out that the most recent revision of the copyright law in 1978 was begun maybe more than 15 years before that. So it's a pretty good law for something that affects copyright as it stood in 1960. So we have to wonder if we begin to try to update the 1978 law in 2013, where we might wind up. It'd be a great law for 2013, but one only approved of maybe in 2050. So these things do move slowly. But thank you for that interesting look at this most recent case, the Kurtzain case. And with that, Andrew, we'll thank you for joining us again this week on Beyond the Book.
Thank you. Always my pleasure.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.